Pub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 50, The Great Brinks Caper. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss the Brinks robbery, an infamous heist in Boston's North End that, in 1950, was the largest robbery to date. The crime captivated the nation and baffled the FBI. But before we talk about gangsters and armored cars, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is October 16th, and on October 16th, 1774, Abigail Adams wrote a letter to John, brooding over the war that now seemed inevitable. The threatening aspect of our public affairs, the complicated distress of this province, the arduous and perplexed business in which you are engaged, have all conspired to agitate my bosom with fears and apprehensions to which I have heretofore been a stranger. And far from thinking the scene closed, it looks as though the curtain was but just drawn, and only the first scene of the infernal plot disclosed, and whether the end will be tragical, heaven alone knows. You cannot be, I know, nor do I wish to see you, an inactive spectator. But if the sword be drawn, I bid adieu to all domestic felicity, and look forward to that country where there is neither war nor rumor of war, in a firm belief that through the mercy of its king we shall both rejoice there together. I greatly fear that the arm of treachery and violence is lifted over us as a scourge, and heavy punishment from heaven for our numerous offenses, and for the misimprovement of our great advantages. If we expect to inherit the blessings of our fathers, we should return a little more to their primitive simplicity of manners, and not sink into inglorious ease. We have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them.
In the late 19th century, Boston was undergoing a bit of an Anglophile fad. At the tail end of a continent-wide tour, the Prince of Wales came to Boston on October 17, 1860. Albert Edward, the eldest son of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, had been touring Canada in the U.S., or, as his official program said, the British North American provinces, for months. He left England on July 9th and visited Newfoundland, Quebec, Ottawa, Niagara Falls, and Windsor. Eventually, he crossed into the U.S. at Detroit and toured Chicago, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, and Baltimore. Before coming to our fair city, he was received by President Lincoln in Washington and spent some time exploring New York City. Apparently, the people of Boston were a little better behaved around royalty than those who lived in some of the cities the prince had visited. Yet no obstruction was experienced, a matter of little surprise in Boston. That the people should have been well behaved in Baltimore or New York was subject of remark. Those cities have obtained such a notoriety for disorderliness of their people that anything to the contrary is unlooked for them. But in Boston, the noble city of Boston, the Puritan city, par excellence, the whole Union would have been struck with amazement had any of the many thousands who assembled in her streets to do honor to the prince manifested anything else than a most Yankee-like propriety of demeanor. The prince stayed for 2 days and was met with adoring crowds at every turn. It's a little embarrassing for a city that started a revolution against his family just 85 years before.
Wednesday is October 18th. Phyllis Wheatley was born in West Africa. When she was 7 or 8 years old, she was kidnapped by slave traders who brought her to America and sold her to the wealthy Boston merchant John Wheatley. The family renamed the enslaved girl with their own last name and gave her the first name Phyllis after the ship that had brought her to North America and to slavery. In the Wheatley household, Phyllis acted as a personal servant for John's wife, Susanna. Unusually for an enslaved person at the time, Phyllis was taught not only reading and writing, but also theology, Greek, Latin, and ancient history and mythology. By the time she was about 14, she began writing poetry. Several of her early poems were published in New England newspapers and periodicals. When she was about 20 years old, she accompanied Nathaniel Wheatley to London in the summer of 1773 to seek a patron who could help publish a book of poetry. On October 18, 1773, Phyllis was back in Boston, and she wrote a letter to Colonel David Wooster of New Haven. In the letter, she describes her visit to London and her efforts to find subscribers for her recently released book. In what seems almost like an afterthought, a paragraph on the second page drops momentous news. Since my return to America, my master has, at the desire of my friends in England, given me my freedom. The instrument is drawn so as to secure me and my property from the hands of the executors, administers, etc. of my master, and secure whatsoever should be given to me as my own. Phyllis Wheatley, famed as the enslaved poet, would be enslaved no more. In 1778, she married a free black man named John Peters. Unfortunately, their life together was not easy. Phyllis wrote a second volume of poetry, but was never able to find a patron to publish it. John would spend time in debtor's prison, and Phyllis would be forced to work as a scullery maid. She died in 1784, at the age of 31.
For generations, the Independent Company of Cadets was a quasi-military organization that provided a personal bodyguard to the governor of Massachusetts and groomed officer candidates for service in the state militia and U.S. Army. Its roots go back as far as 1726, when Benjamin Pollard attempted to organize a company of cadets in Boston. At the time, they had no military status and had to provide their own weapons and uniforms. A new newspaper from July of that year notes how they provided a ceremonial guard to Governor Burnett. About 6 o'clock, the company of young gentlemen cadets in their order and gaiety waited upon His Excellence and escorted him to the house of the Honorable Elijah Cook, Esquire. The company fired 3 volleys and exercised their arms with their vaunted beauty and exactness before they were dismissed. That early incarnation only lasted for a couple of years before it dissolved. The replacement was an independent company of cadets that was officially organized on October 19, 1741. They were chartered as a unit of the provincial militia, with their leader Benjamin Pollard holding a dual commission as the captain of cadets and a lieutenant colonel of the militia. Their first official duty was to accompany Governor Shirley on a trip to the Rhode Island state line. Over the next 3 decades, their duties would be mostly ceremonial, but as tensions rose in the years before the Revolutionary War broke out, they would sometimes be called on to keep the peace in Boston when tensions ran high. Finally, in 1774, the company voted to disband itself in protest after Governor Gage fired John Hancock from his position as commander of the cadet company. After the British evacuated Boston, the Company of Cadets reformed in the spring of 1776 and elected John Hancock, by then serving as president of the Second Continental Congress, as their honorary colonel. In more modern history, the Company of Cadets was reorganized as an engineering company in 1917 and saw heavy combat in World War I with the 26th Infantry Yankee Division. In the 1920s, they reorganized, again as an artillery company, and were activated for service in World War II. Today, their legacy is carried on by the 211th Military Police Battalion, 1st Corps of Cadets, which saw combat as recently as 2003 in Iraq. To learn more about the Independent Company of Cadets and their conversion to the Patriot cause in the run-up to the American Revolution, check out episode 20.
Friday is October 20th. For decades after the tidal back bay was filled and turned into a posh neighborhood, there was a lively debate over whether to dam the mouth of the Charles River. Some opponents remembered earlier dam projects that created stagnant, sewage-filled lagoons and feared the same fate would befall the Charles. Others worked for industries that still relied on moving goods into or out of the Charles River basin by ship, or worried that their investments in the back bay real estate market would be devalued. Against these stood the argument that tidal erosion threatened the new lands created in the Back Bay, and that maintaining seawalls against the tides was an expensive inconvenience. Most of all, though, proponents of the dam pointed out that twice a day low tides left hundreds of feet of mudflats exposed along the banks of the Charles. And, as George Santayana recalled, "under your nose rose now and then the stench of mudflats and sewage that the sluggish current did not avail to drain properly." In the end, the state agreed that a dam should be built. On October 20, 1908, the dam was closed, and the Charles River was forever cut off from the sea. An article in the November 1908 edition of the Harvard Engineering Journal describes the moment when the floodgates were closed. There were 82 gates constructed, which ran in grooves built on heavy uprights. The gates were of 6x8-inch timber, braced lengthwise and diagonally, forming solid pieces 10 feet wide by 15 feet high. Across the top of these uprights were placed timbers, the gates being held to these by ropes. At a given signal, these ropes were cut, and in 7 seconds, all of the gates were in place. Rubber hose was nailed on the bottom edge of each gate, that the joint between the gates and the sheet piling might be as close as possible. As soon as the river was closed, the uprights projecting above the round piling were cut off and removed, and rehandlers and dredges began at once to pile earth against the shutoff. That temporary earthen dam would eventually be finished as a granite-walled dam with an earthen fill. In 1978, a new dam just downstream would replace it. Today, the original dam is used as a bridge, and as the home of our Museum of Science.
In the mid-19th century, Boston's wealthy merchant class were the leading opponents to the abolition movement. In a bizarre inversion of today's social movements, these proper gentlemen would take to the streets in pro-slavery demonstrations that sometimes spill over into riots. On October 21, 1835, the British abolitionist George Thompson was invited to speak to a small group of activists at the offices of William Lloyd Garrison's Liberator. That evening, a pro-slavery crowd assembled on Washington Street that the Boston Commercial Gazette described as an assemblage of 1,500 or 2,000 highly respectable gentlemen. President Trump probably would have called them very fine people. They marched to the office of the Liberator, but Thompson hadn't arrived yet. Seeing the mob assembling outside, Mayor Theodore Lyman urged the women in the audience to leave for their own safety. Maria Chapman, founder of the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society, was having none of it. She said, "If this is the last bulwark of freedom, we may as well die here as anywhere." When the mob got in, they attacked Garrison, eventually dragging the dazed man through the streets. It took a posse of 30 or 40 men to defend him from the mob of gentlemen long enough to lock him in the Leverett Street jail for his own protection. While he was there, he would write some graffiti on the wall of his cell. William Lloyd Garrison was put into this cell on Wednesday afternoon, October 21st, 1835, to save him from the violence of a respectable and influential mob who sought to destroy him for preaching the abominable and dangerous doctrine that all men are created equal and that all oppression is odious in the sight of God.
Finally, Sunday is October 22nd, and on October 22nd, 1881, the Boston Symphony Orchestra gave its first public concert. Civil War veteran and philanthropist Henry Lee Higginson had realized his dream of starting a European-style orchestra in his hometown. Later he'd recall, "In February 81, I began to put in shape a scheme conceived 25 years before that date, namely to give orchestral concerts of the best attainable character and quality at a price which should admit anyone and everyone likely to care for such things. My hope was to draw in by degrees a larger and less educated class of society. I had meant to engage an orchestra and a conductor to be at my beck and call, because this only could I ask and get practice sufficient in amount and quality to reach the playing of the great German orchestras." That first night, the orchestra was led by conductor George Henschel. They opened with Beethoven's Consecration of the House Overture, followed by a piece by Gluck and a Haydn symphony. After the intermission, there were lighter pieces by Schubert, Max Bruch, and Weber. It was a success. DeWolf Hall's History of the BSO recalls, "With the audience, the concert found the highest favor. The construction of the program, with the overture, soloist, and finally the symphony before the intermission, which was followed by lighter music intended to send the hearers home in good humor, seemed ideal. The musical critics of the local press found much to commend in this first concert."
Now let's jump to our main topic. Boston is, of course, no stranger to organized crime. Highlights include the decades-long saga of Whitey Bulger, the continuing quest to recover artwork stolen from the Gardner Museum, and King Solomon's reign in the South End, discussed in episode 38. Today, we'll dig into the Brinks robbery in 1950. Brinks is an armored car service, still in business today. Essentially, businesses use them to transport money. If you own a bar or a convenience store or some other type of business that brings in a lot of cash, you might hire Brinks to do regular pickups, so you don't have to run the risks associated with going to the bank with $20,000 in your pocket. In the era of the robbery, before the days of direct deposit, Brinks would also deliver the payroll to factories. The Brinks building, which sat on the corner of Prince and Commercial Streets, was robbed on January 17, 1950. The 11-member gang made off with $2.7 million in cash, checks, and securities. That's $27 million in today's money. The tale that unfolds will really sound like a new installment of Ocean's 11, so let's imagine George Clooney in the role of ringleader Joseph Big Joe McGinnis. Of course, this kind of thing isn't pulled off on a whim, and it certainly isn't accomplished by one person. According to Joseph Specs O'Keefe, the filthy rat, Big Joe began planning and assembling his crew about 2 years before the robbery. He started by enlisting Specs, Anthony Fats Pino, and Stanley Gus Gusciera. They meticulously observed the employees' daily routine from an apartment that they rented in the building across the street, learning the patterns and identifying the best times to enter the building undetected. Specs and Gus first entered the building by picking the outside lock with an ice pick and the inner door with a piece of plastic. They then removed the cylinders from the five locks so that a locksmith could make duplicate keys for them, replacing the cylinders before the morning shift arrived. And with that, they could come and go as they pleased.
Once this was done, Fats recruited seven other men. Vincent Costa, Michael Vincent Gagan, Thomas Sandy Francis Richardson, Adolf Jazz Maffey, Henry Conan, James Faherty, and Joseph Banfield. Members of the crew went into the building several times after hours to memorize the layout and practice their planned entrance and escape. Specs and Gus even broke into an alarm company in Boston to review the plans of the security system inside the Brinks building, returning the plans before the theft was noticed.
With all this buildup, you can understand why this story was made into a movie.
Absolutely, and the tension is still building. After six aborted attempts, they decided that the time was right. Those who were to carry out the plan donned clothing similar to that of a Brinks uniform with navy peacoats and chauffeur's caps, along with rubber Halloween masks, gloves, and rubber-soled shoes. While two remained in the getaway car, seven others entered the building at 6:55 p.m. With their copied keys, they easily came to the second floor through locked doors and surprised, bound, and gagged five Brinks employees who were storing and counting money. Surprisingly, not a shot was fired, no blood was shed. The robbers actually said, "This is a stick-up," and they met no opposition. Other than the payroll for GE, which was in a box that they couldn't open, everything was quickly collected and the crew walked out at 7:30 p.m. They committed what was the biggest robbery in U.S. history in just 35 minutes. They immediately split up, established alibis, and agreed not to touch the money for 6 years, after which the statute of limitations would expire.
Boston police and the FBI rounded up every suspect they could find. Rope, adhesive tape, one hat, and a witness observing the getaway were the only initial pieces of evidence. In addition to interviewing hundreds of neighbors, a systematic check of current and past Brinks employees was undertaken, building personnel were questioned, and salesmen, messengers, and others who visited Brinks were investigated. The company offered a $100,000 reward, but hundreds of leads only led to dead ends. A profile on the FBI's website details the biggest lead in those early months. Through the interviews of persons in the vicinity of the Brinks offices on the evening of January 17, 1950, the FBI learned that a 1949 green Ford steak body truck with a canvas top had been parked near the Prince Street door of Brinks at approximately the time of the robbery. From the size of the loot and the number of the men involved, it was logical that the gang might have used a truck. This lead was pursued intensively. On March 4th, pieces of an identical truck were found at a dump in Stoughton, Massachusetts. An acetylene torch had been used to cut up the truck, and it appeared that a sledgehammer also had been used to smash many of the heavy parts, such as the motor. The truck pieces were concealed in fiber bags when found. Had the ground not been frozen, the person or persons who abandoned the bags probably would have attempted to bury them. The truck found at the dump had been reported stolen by a Ford dealer near Fenway Park in Boston on November 3, 1949. All efforts to identify the persons responsible for the theft and the persons who had cut up the truck were unsuccessful. The fiber bags used to conceal the pieces were identified as having been used as containers for beef bones shipped from South America to a gelatin manufacturing company in Massachusetts. Thorough inquiries were made concerning the disposition of the bags after their receipt by the Massachusetts firm. This phase of the investigation was pursued exhaustively. It proved unproductive. But, as the case went cold, there was one thing that Big Joe and Fats couldn't plan for. Something that was completely beyond their control. It's hard enough to keep a secret and maintain trust between two people. And I gotta tell you, if I'm one of those two people, the secret probably isn't gonna be kept. So, with 11 people, it was destined for failure. Just 6 months later in June, Specs and Gus were arrested in Pennsylvania for a burglary. Apparently, their share of the $20 million wasn't enough. Specs was sentenced to 3 years in jail, and Gus landed with a 5 to 20 year sentence. And here, the plot thickens. Specs had given his share of the money to Jazz for safekeeping before both he and Gus demanded more money from Fats and Big Joe to fight their convictions. Informants passed this tip to the police, and FBI agents tried to talk to Specs and Gus, but they denied any knowledge of the Brinks robbery.
Upon his release, Specs was taken to trial for another burglary and parole violations, and was released on a bail of $17,000. He never saw his portion of the loot after he gave it to Jazz, who ended up doing time for tax evasion. In need of money, he kidnapped Costa and demanded ransom. Fats paid a small ransom, but then decided that things were way out of hand and that Specs needed to be killed. After some failed attempts, he hired Elmer Trigger Burke. Trigger shot Specs on June 16, 1954, seriously wounding, but failing to kill him. Specs went off the grid after he was wounded, and then on August 1, 1954, he was arrested and turned over to the Boston police, who held him for violating probation on a gun-carrying charge. He was sentenced on August 5, 1954 to serve 27 months in prison. As a protective measure, he was incarcerated in the Hampden County Jail at Springfield, rather than the Suffolk County Jail in Boston. On August 3rd, his associate, who had assisted him in holding Costa for ransom, disappeared. Combined, these events created a resentment that would eventually lead Specs to turn. As the FBI tells it, during an interview with him in the jail at Springfield in October, special agents found that the plight of the missing Boston racketeer was weighing on Specs' mind. In December, he indicated to the agents that Fats could look for rough treatment if he again was released. From his cell in Springfield, O'Keefe wrote bitter letters to members of the Brinks gang and persisted in his demands for money. The conviction for burglary in McKean County, Pennsylvania still hung over his head, and legal fees remained to be paid. During 1955, O'Keefe carefully pondered his position. It appeared to him that he would spend his remaining days in prison while his co-conspirators would have many years to enjoy the luxuries of life. Even if released, he thought, his days were numbered. There had been three attempts on his life in June 1954, and his frustrated assassins undoubtedly were waiting for him to return to Boston. Evidently resigned to long years in prison, or a short life on the outside, O'Keefe grew increasingly bitter toward his old associates. Through long weeks of empty promises of assistance and deliberate stalling by the gang members, he began to realize that his threats were falling on deaf ears. As long as he was in prison, he could do no physical harm to his Boston criminal associates. And the gang felt that the chances of his talking were negligible because he would be implicated in the Brinks robbery along with the others. 2 days after Christmas of 1955, FBI agents paid another visit to O'Keefe. After a period of hostility, he began to display a friendly attitude. Interviewed again on December 28th, he talked somewhat more freely, and it was obvious that the agents were gradually winning his respect and confidence. At 4:20 p.m. on January 6, 1956, O'Keefe made the final decision. He was through with Pino, Baker, McInnes, Maffey, and the other Brinks conspirators who had turned against him. "All right," he told two FBI agents, "what do you want to know?"
On January 12, 1956, just 5 days before the statute of limitations was set to run out, the FBI arrested Baker, Costa, Gagan, Jazz, Big Joe, and Fats. Specs pled guilty on January 18th. They apprehended Faherty and Sandy on May 16th, and Gus died on July 9th. Banfield was already dead. The trial began on August 6th, 1956. 8 of the gang members received maximum sentences of life imprisonment. All were paroled by 1971, except Big Joe, who died in prison. Specs received 4 years and was released in 1960. At the end of the day, the money was never recovered. A lead occurred in June 1956, when a $10 bill from the robbery was passed to an arcade employee in Baltimore. The money was eventually traced to an office building in Boston, on Tremont Street, concealed inside a wall. About $52,000 in Brink's money was recovered from that building, just about 2% of the loot.
To learn more about the Brink's robbery, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/050. We'll have a link to a detailed account of the crime from the FBI, links to several movies about the Brink's robbery, and a link to The Men Who Robbed Brink's, a 1961 as-told-to book about the robbery and its aftermath, on which Specs collaborated.
We'll also include a link to The Great Muppet Caper, my favorite.
And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries. We do have a little bit of listener feedback this week through a recent iTunes review.
An interesting podcast centering on Boston area history. The actual episodes are far from in-depth, but do provide fascinating insights into lesser-known events of the past. Best of all is the accompanying website, which provides related links and information to further explore. Unfortunately, both speakers insist upon injecting their liberal ideology into too many episodes. This is simply a shame, as this seriously detracts from the end product and no doubt limits the scope of listeners.
First of all, thanks for the review. We don't have that many. We've privately discussed how much to allow our personal views to influence the show, and we decided that we're fine with it. We don't alter historical facts to fit a political narrative, but we also won't uncritically accept a history that frequently includes racism, xenophobia, misogyny, and homophobia. We get enough of that from today's news. We don't need it in our podcast as well. So our values are going to continue to influence the show, but we hope you keep listening.
Do you agree with that review or disagree? Head over to iTunes and leave us a review of your own. As we always say, it's the best way to help others find the show. If you want to get in touch with us directly, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week with a show about the Confederates on Boston Harbor.